clamped down hard on her emotions to keep from bursting into tears. Cruel. So cruel. How could Gavin do such a thing and then smile at her? Because that's how the Chromeria is. Vipers and villains, all of them. And Corvin had done everything he could to try to keep Liv out of the Chromeria, everything short of ordering her not to go because he wasn't so imperious. It was her fault. Liv swallowed the sudden lump in her throat. Her father had been debased because of her. He deserved better than for her to expose his shame. She smiled as bravely as she could, pretending to acquiesce.
I understand, Father. I do trust you. Just tell me everything when you can. Fair enough?
Fair enough, Corvin said, his relief obvious. I love you, Livy.
I know you do, Father.
And Gavin Gyle was going to pay for turning that love against him. Chapter 64.
It's simple, Kip. You're not being asked to draft a pulley or a skull. One little green ball. It's nothing.
He was sitting cross-legged, green spectacles on, white board in his lap, willing something to happen. He'd been doing this for 2 hours. And what exactly was he doing? Nothing. How were you supposed to even keep your mind on drafting when nothing happened for hours? His stomach was complaining again. It was constant now as the sun approached noon. No food until I draft? It's cruel. It's torture. It's impossible. Kip looked up. Gavin had brought them only a few hundred paces outside the Lover's Gate, to the ruins of the old outer walls. When they'd arrived, there were already hundreds of men at work, and since then many of those who'd been stuck in the line that they'd passed had joined them. They were excavating the roots of the wall down to bedrock, which was at least 4 paces down in the few places Kip could see. The excavation, though, went faster than he would have thought possible, between the sheer number of men working and the sandy soil, with only thin vegetation on top. Gavin was poring over drawings with Master Danavis. General Danavis, Kip supposed, and the natural manner with which the general commanded men to do this or that, exactly how he told Kip to go do this or that, made Kip wonder why he'd never wondered about Master Danavis before. The man was obviously too big for a little town like Recton, but Kip had never even thought about him. Children only think about themselves, Kip. It's not good enough, Gavin was saying. No, the detail's fine, the detail's perfect, but the old wall didn't stop us, so why rebuild something that's faulty? Rebuild the wall? Hadn't Gavin said that King Haradul's army was arriving in 4 or 5 days?
We'll be lucky if we can get something that's merely faulty, General Danavis said. We'll be lucky if we can finish anything at all.
Bring me the drawings of Rathcason, the Prism said.
You're seriously going to build a wall based on artists' renditions of a mythical city?
The muscle in Gavin's jaw twitched with irritation.
Understood, Lord Prism, General Danvers said.
He bobbed a bow.
Bring your daughter, Gavin said. I could use a superviolet.
A slight hesitation.
Of course.
The general left, mounting his horse and galloping toward the city, his Hrothgari personal guards trailing in his wake. Then, though he'd been speaking non-stop with foremen, Hrothgari guards, and General Danavis all morning, Gavin was suddenly alone. He looked over at Kip.
Oops. I think I'm supposed to be drafting.
Gavin cocked an eyebrow at him.
Not hungry yet, huh?
Kip grimaced.
Thanks for reminding me.
Kip, more than any other color, green can be summarized in one word. All the others require at least a few, a bit of hedging, some qualifiers. Green is wild. Everything both good and bad associated with wild is what green is. That's why I can tell you that you only need will, because will and wildness go so naturally together. If you were an incipient blue, I'd have to explain the sense of drafting, the harmony, the order, how it fits with the world. That's not you. Any questions?
Not about drafting.
What happened to that gunner?
What? Gavin asked.
The one on the Elysian boat who nearly killed us. Right before I shot him, his gun blew up.
It does happen, Gavin said. You overcharge your shot, the musket can't handle the charge.
That gunner,
who nearly hit us from 500 paces. He misjudged a musket.
Gavin smiled. He turned his palm over. There was nothing in it. Oh, Kip tightened his eyes. A superviolet ball rested in Gavin's hand.
See it?
Gavin asked.
I see it.
Gavin extended his hand. A little pop, and his hand jumped back. The superviolet ball streaked out like it was a musket ball itself.
I blocked his musket barrel, Gavin said, shrugging. You can use any color to do it. Yellow only if you can make solid yellow, of course, but pretty much anything else.
Why not kill him?
I may have, Gavin said. A musket exploding in your hands is no joke.
He shrugged.
I recognized him. Freelancer during the war. Sometimes fought for me, sometimes for my brother, sometimes for any captain that would pay him enough. He's a drunk and a scoundrel and the finest artist of the canon in the 7 satrapies. Whatever name he was born with, now he's simply known as Gunner. It's everything he is. His first underdeck commander's cannoneer was on a ship called the Arved Beraya, the Fire Breather.
The Fire Breather? The Fire Breather?
Kip asked.
Only ship in memory to ever kill a full-grown sea demon. Gunner was maybe 16 years old.
Gavin shook his head, dispelling a memory.
I've killed a lot of people, Kip. Sometimes you hesitate. And as bad and as dangerous as that is, I like to think it's proof that I've still got some humanity left. Besides, I knew making his gun blow up in his hands would really infuriate him. If I know Gunner, he made that musket himself. And he's probably wondering who the hell overcharged his precious musket.
He glanced over to a richly dressed Hrothgari approaching, flanked by guards and slaves carrying a mobile pavilion to shade the light-skinned man.
"I'll leave you to your work," Gavin said. "You might want to hurry. The servants should be bringing lunch any time."
"Just when I'd sort of forgotten my stomach. Thanks." Kip pushed the spectacles up his nose. They kept slipping down, and they weren't even close to comfortable, and stared at the white board.
Wild. Wild, unbridled, growing.
The Hrothgari noble, Kip gathered it was the governor, was complaining shrilly to Gavin about something or other, and he stood as if he was going to take his time about it. Kip tried to block him out.
Green. Come on, let's suck up some wildness.
Wild. Now there's a word for me. Kip the Wild. I was pretty wild when Ram used to call me Tubby, huh? I was pretty wild when he made me back down over Issa. She'd be alive if I'd been a little wilder. To be wild is the opposite of being controlled, and I've been controlled for my whole life. Controlled by Ram.
By Ram! A village tough, a boy, barely a bully.
If Kip had told Ram to go to the Evernight, if he had shredded Ram with his tongue, what could Ram have done except beat him? Ram's muscles weren't half a match for Kip's brain.
Well, they're not a match for anything now that they're rotting.
The thought made Kip queasy. He didn't want Ram dead. There'd been plenty of good things about the boy. A few, anyway. And if Kip didn't feel terrible that Ram was dead, he did wish the boy were alive so he could face him now. I've talked with Gavin Gile. I sank pirates with him. Well, mostly I tried not to drown while he sank pirates, but still.
Kip looked at his hands. Still no Luxon.
The governor was still complaining loudly.
What a hollum, how was Gavin standing it? The man had the most nasal voice Kip had ever heard.
Kip wanted to bean the man in the head with a big old ball of green Luxon. He glanced at his hands again. Nothing. I'm going to fail, Gavin. Again. Like I failed Issa. Like I failed Sanson. Like I failed my mother 1,000 times. Hunger gnawed Kip's belly. That's all I am. A fat failure. A new life's been handed to me on a plate. Gavin Gile's son. Bastard son, sure, but he hasn't once treated me like an embarrassment, and I can't even summon the will to reach out and take this new life. In return for all the good he's done me, I'm going to humiliate the man who saved my life, who gave me a second chance.
It was like bands of iron were being laid across his chest, and now they tightened.
Tightened.
Kip could barely breathe. His eyes welled with tears. Baby. Failure. Disappointment. His mother's face twisted dangerously high from smoking ratweed laced with ergot.
You ruined my life. You're the worst mistake I ever made. I gave everything and you took it all and gave me nothing. You make me sick, Kip.
Kip, you can't throw off those chains. Stop believing those...
Lies! The governor shouted.
Kip shivered, his skin tingling. The sun was nearly at its zenith. Orholm's eye pressed down on the land like a physical weight, but to Kip it was a caress. Light, energy, warmth, love, light in dark corners. He looked at the whiteboard, and in the green filtered through his spectacles he saw one face of Orholm. Kip wouldn't call it wildness. It was freedom. He wanted to shout, dance, for joy, to hell with what anyone thought. There was freedom from all of that, and freedom from the prison of his own head. Freedom from the nagging voices of doubt, from the running commentary about everything he saw and did. It was action, and it was as powerful as a redwood springing up in the cracks of a boulder. Life would win. The roots would reach and heave and strain. Kip could feel those bands of iron around his chest burst asunder. He felt more alive than he had in his whole life, an animal strength and joy. So this is what they mean by wild. The yapping governor's voice shrilled. Kip drew a ball of green luxin into his hand. Just like that? Just by deciding to do it? It seemed too easy. The ball was thick, dense, but flexible to his squeezing fingers. Kip made it bigger, hollow, about twice the size of his own head. Now the flexibility was exaggerated, soft enough that it wasn't going to kill anyone. With the biggest grin on his face, Kip held it in his palms. How had Gavin shot out Luxin? Kip had seen Iron Fist do it, too. He wrinkled his nose. Maybe I just will it. A tiny part of his mind was protesting. You can't assault the governor. He's the governor, for Orholm's sake. You think his bodyguards are going to appreciate that you don't really mean to hurt him? But in the grip of green, words like governor were bled of meaning. What was that? What was the difference? The trappings of human rituals and human titles seemed artificial, thin. Kip willed the ball to shoot out of his hands. Still seated, grinning like a fool, he could feel energy coiling up behind the ball. How long did he let that build before he let it go? Oh, well, that felt like long enough. A muffled crack, and the ball jetted out of Kip's hands, fast. Still seated on the ground, he was blasted arse over elbows. Rolling to his knees, laughing, Kip looked to see what had happened to the yapping man. The governor was laid out, and apparently the green Luxin ball had bounced around some, because the palanquin was collapsing, two of the slaves tumbling away from it. The palanquin dropped right on top of the governor, and Kip heard him shrieking. But his view was blocked as one of the bodyguards charged Kip, sword out. Spectacles askew, Kip couldn't draw any more green, but he still had a good amount in his body. He began drawing another smaller ball. Too slow, too slow! The air shimmered between him and the swordsman as he raised his hands. There was a crack from his hands and a tiny green ball shot out, snapping both hands back painfully from the kick. A wall of blue luxin unfurled between Kip and the swordsman in the blink of an eye. The swordsman's sword struck the blue wall in mid-lunge toward the kneeling boy. The blade screeched as it was forced downward, peeling off layers of blue. The swordsman himself smacked bodily into the blue a split second later, grunting. There was a sound like glass cracking and a high-pitched whine. The swordsman recovered, then stopped. The blue luxin right in front of his face was cracked from Kip's shot. Spiderwebs centered where his head would have been. A musket-ball-sized crater in the blue luxin. Enough, Gavin said. He didn't raise his voice, just injected it in a moment of silence. His blue wall had saved both of them. Kip felt shaken, weak. Oh, shit. What did I just do? The governor, still protesting, was pulled from the fallen palanquin by two of his bodyguards. He stood, nose bleeding, face flushed from embarrassment, rapidly giving way to rage, and stormed over to Gavin.
"Your slave has assaulted me. I demand satisfaction."
The governor drew the decorative blade hanging at his hip and pointed it at Kip. A muscle jumped in Gavin's jaw. "That's no slave. Kip is my natural son."
"This is your bastard?"
Stony silence from Gavin. Finally, "Kip, apologize." Kip swallowed and stood, unable to conceal his trembling.
"I'm terribly sorry, sir. I was practicing drafting for the first time. I really didn't know what I was..."
"An apology? No, Lord Prism. First you assault me, and now this outrage? I demand satisfaction."
"You'll demand nothing," Gavin said. He never broke eye contact. "You're corrupt, if not treasonous, Governor Crassus. You've been colluding with King Haradul, and if I can find just a little more evidence of it, I swear when you return to Hrothgar, your head will have a pike waiting for it. Unless Satrapa Ptolus decides to hand you over to the Parians instead. You're incompetent, contemptible, a liar, a thief, and a coward. If you want satisfaction, you can duel with me, sword to sword. On my word of honor, I won't draft, but we'll do it right now."
The governor blinked, and the sword point trembled. He blinked again, sheathed his blade.
"I'll leave brawling with swords to the benighted," he snarled, and turned on his heel, storming off.
Kip became aware that someone was right behind him. He turned and saw Ironfist looming over him.
"How long have you been there?" he asked.
"Long enough to protect you from your foolishness, if not long enough to stop it. I wasn't aware you had your family's knack for getting into trouble in the blink of an eye."
Oh, the blue wall had been Ironfist's. Was that twice over now that Kip owed his life to the huge blackguard?
"Commander," Gavin said, "I need you to go speak with our spies. Crassus is rattled. He may run. Make sure the crews manning the cannons at the harbor's entrance are men who will obey the order to fire if it comes to that, and that he doesn't plunder the treasury. I need to be able to pay our army."
Ironfist frowned.
"I'd prefer not to leave Kip. I'm a blackguard, Lord Prism, not a messenger. My duty is here."
Gavin said, "I can't do it. Kip can't do it. It needs doing. This is my fault for forbidding you to bring more blackguards, but the point remains."
Commander Ironfist hesitated only 1 second more.
"Very well, Lord Prism."
He bowed and headed for the horses someone had brought for them. When he had gone, there was a conspicuous silence. Dozens of workmen had seen what had happened, and humiliating the governor had clearly earned Gavin some goodwill, but no one appeared to want to come close, either, lest Gavin was angry. Gavin rubbed his forehead. "You're probably wondering why we're going to fight a war for assholes like that governor," he said. Actually, the thought hadn't occurred to Kip, but now that Gavin brought it up, it did seem odd. "Because Rask Haradul had the stench of a fanatic, Kip. That's all. Hundreds, or if we're unlucky, thousands of people will die because I met Rask for a few minutes and I thought he was crazy." Gavin expelled a breath. "He wants this city, and honestly, he's got a right to it. If I could simply give this city back to Tyria's people, I would. They deserve it. You have paid too high of a price for a war in which they took the only side they could. If there were anyone else who would take over after we left, I'd do it and damn the spectrum. But with Rask in power... It's a little more complicated than that, of course, but that's why I'm here, and my presence is what will make this a near thing. If we left, Rask would march in unopposed, close the harbor before the Parians could land, and that would be pretty much the end of it. The Parians would be furious, but the profits here aren't so great that they want to march an army here. Eventually, Rask would offer an exclusive shipping contract on all the citrus from Garriston for a few years, and they'd take it. What do you think? Is it worth it?"
"He's asking me like my opinion is worth something."
Kip hadn't had that many adults care what he thought.
"I think King Haradul should die and save us all this trouble."
Gavin laughed ruefully.
"If only. Maybe Caris will work a miracle and do just that."
"You really miss her, don't you?"
Kip asked before he could stop himself.
Gavin looked at Kip sharply. Then he looked away, relented. After a minute he expelled a long breath, and it was like Kip was watching Gavin's hope leak out of him.
"That obvious, huh?" Gavin asked.
"You think they'll kill her?" Kip asked.
A number of emotions flitted over Gavin's face, settling in resignation, sorrow, too deep for tears.
"She'll live until Rask sees if I'll trade the city for her. Then he'll kill her, either way."
"No. No, they won't," Kip thought. "I swear it."
Chapter 65. The empty feeling in Kip's stomach didn't go away when they served lunch. Gavin and General Danavis, even though it was weird to think of him as General Danavis rather than Master Danavis, it was too weird for Kit to think of him as just Corvin, and even Liv were poring over the drawings and plans with architects and artists while they ate. Kip sat to one side, out of the way. He had no idea what they were doing, and space around the table was limited. He ate fresh oranges with gusto and tore into the intriguing, spiced, fresh javelina. It tasted amazing, but even he couldn't keep his mind on food for long.
"I'd ask if you're serious," General Danavis was saying, "but you have that look."
"The problem isn't the drafting," Gavin said. "I can handle that much Luxin easily."
"Easily?"
General Danavis interrupted, dubiously. "Fine, not easily, but I can do it. The problem is the weight. I can't lift this much, much less throw it into place." Liv cleared her throat gently, as if unsure she really wanted to intrude. "Oliviana?" Gavin asked. She coloured.
"Please, Liv."
She brushed her hair back nervously.
"How about this?"
She drafted something onto the table. It was, of course, superviolet and thus invisible to most people. General Danavis scowled. Apparently, most people included him.
"Sorry, Father," she said. "I can't control yellow enough to make models with it."
Kip tried to see what she'd drafted, but the table was obscured by bodies. Gavin chuckled. "It looks ridiculous," he said, and Liv blanched. "But it'll work. Perfect, fine. What do our architects think of the design?" For a moment, Kip thought Gavin was being pretty rude. Obviously, General Danavis and everyone else around the table was curious about what Liv had designed, but this was Gavin as leader. All the rest of them didn't need to know, and there was work to be done. He understood the solution to the problem, and that was all that was necessary. On to the next problem. "Which is what I should be doing." Kip had finished lunch. He could now draft a little bit, and on purpose. He knew what he had to do.
"My Lord Prism, none of us has ever built a wall of this magnitude, or
a wall at all, to tell the truth," a nervous architect said.
"But these old drawings you've shown us of Rathcason are clearly flawed. Too much fantasy, not enough function."
"This empty desert doesn't have enough function," Gavin said sharply. "Tell me what we need to do to fix it. I need to start building now, today." The architect blinked, swallowed.
Here. He drew a line with his finger. "This interior passage isn't wide enough. You're going to have men rushing back and forth in armor with guns, cannons being rolled into position or replaced for repair. This passage must be wide enough for men to run past each other, and past carts or cannons."
"How wide?" Gavin demanded.
"I'd say,
He held his fingers apart on the drawing.
"For a Hullam's sake, write on it," Gavin said.
"Sir, those drawings are hundreds of years old, priceless relics of—" another man, perhaps an artist, protested.
"Priceless is being alive next week," Gavin snapped. "Continue."
Kip didn't know why he'd been so slow, but it only dawned on him now that Gavin was seriously planning on building a wall here, before King Haradul's army arrived, in 4 days.
Oh, maybe because it's impossible?
Of course, crossing the Cerulean Sea in a morning was impossible, too. But seriously, did Gavin mean to draft the entire thing by himself? Kip didn't know all that much about drafting and how much a drafter could safely use in a day, but the mere fact that the world wasn't bursting with Luxin buildings and bridges and walls told him that it had to be incredibly difficult. In fact, the only Luxin buildings he'd seen had been at the Chromeria, and he had to guess that the Seven Towers had been the product of a huge collaborative effort. The architect, a squinting little man after puffing out his cheeks a number of times, deep in thought, began drawing quickly.
"The cutouts on these murder holes don't give sufficient range of fire. If you modify the top of the wall like this, scaling ladders won't be able to hook onto the wall, at least not as easily. A railing on the back, like so, will save more of your own men from falling off the wall than theirs. These areas on top of the wall need to be bigger so you can store more powder for the cannons. There's no place in these drawings for taking the wounded. I think you could incorporate that here. If you can set sleds like this right into the wall of the interior passage, it'll be easier to move material around. There are also no lantern hooks in this plan. Your wall will be entirely dark if you don't fix this. You'll need cranes here, here, and here to lift supplies."
"You've never built a wall before," Huh? Gavin asked.
I have studied a few, the architect said.
How much am I paying you?
Nothing yet, Lord Prism.
Well, double it, Gavin ordered. The architect looked befuddled, obviously doing the arithmetic and not liking the result, but not wanting to call the Prism himself out on it.
He's joking, General Danvers told the man.
Gavin's eyes sparkled.
Oh,
the man looked relieved. Then Kip could see the question cross his face. Joking about giving me nothing? Or joking about giving me more for doing a good job? Gavin said, Keep working. This man here will take notes. I'm going to lay the foundation.
He means that metaphorically, right?
The architect asked, squinting at the receding figure of the Prism.
Our Prisms are bare for metaphors, General Danvers said.
Huh?
The architect asked. Kip stood, feeling heartsick. Now was going to be as good of a chance to escape as he was going to get.
Kip!
Gavin's voice rang out, drawing everyone's eye to Kip. Kip felt a surge of panic and embarrassment at having been caught so easily.
Well done today. It's not many boys who can draft consciously on their first day of trying.
A flush of pleasure went through Kip, only doubled by the impressed look that flitted over Liv's face.
Liv! Gavin called out, making her head whip around. I want you to make models. Lay out the curvature of the halls, widths for the top of the wall, whatever the architect tells you.
Yes, Lord Prism,
she said, her eyes turning back to the table and her work. Now or never. If he waited, Iron Fist would be back, shadowing him wherever he went. Kip looked at General Danvers, head down, making suggestions. Liv, listening intently, and finally at Gavin. These were the only people in the world who meant anything to him, and incredibly, they accepted him. Tolerated him, anyway. With them, for the first time in his life, he felt like he was part of something. Kip turned his back and walked toward the city. Chapter 66 It was only as Kip approached the Lover's Gate that he understood why Gavin was attempting to build a new wall. The old wall was encrusted with homes, shops, and inns, like a ship with barnacles, except here the walls were covered both inside and out. In places, people's roofs were almost level with the top of the wall. If Gavin wanted to make that wall defensible, he'd have to level hundreds of homes. The demolition itself would have taken 4 days. Clearly, the effect on the people's opinion of demolishing the homes of perhaps a fifth of the city's population would be ruinous. Gavin had only a few days in which to make the people who remained in the city want to fight for him rather than for his enemy. He'd been caught between impossible choices. Leave the people's homes propped against the inner walls and have a militarily indefensible wall, or tear the houses down and risk turning an already divided populace against him. So Gavin had decided to build his own wall. Unbelievable. How must it have been during the Prism's War, when people had to choose which brother to fight beside? It would have been like fighting beside giants, knowing that their slightest move might crush you, but knowing that standing in the no-man's land between them would be even worse. Kip found his way back to his rooms and packed what he guessed he'd need. Cloak and food, and more food, and short sword, and a stick of 10 dinars in a money belt. It was more than he thought he'd need. He hoped they'd forgive him for that, but he might need money for bribes. Then he decided he'd need to leave a note so they didn't waste precious time searching for him. There was a quill and a parchment on the desk in his room, so he scratched out the letters laboriously. I'm Tyrian and young. More help as a spy than here. No one will suspect me. We'll try to find Karis. He signed the note, folded it after the ink dried, and stuck it under the covers in Liv's bed. Then he scratched out another one. Went to buy some food and watch minstrel shows, shaken after drafting. We'll be back by midnight. That one he left on the desk. They would find it first and give him a head start. They wouldn't find out he was truly gone until after nightfall. At that point, they'd know he would be too far gone for them to catch him. With what he felt must have been suspiciously overloaded saddlebags, Kip made his way past the gate guards into the stable.
I need a horse,
Kip told the stableman imperiously. The man returned his gaze, not moving from his position, leaning against one wall.
Right place, he said.
Kip had a sinking feeling. The man wasn't buying that he was anyone who could give orders. If Kip couldn't get a horse, he couldn't do anything. It would be the shortest attempt at running away in history. He hadn't even gotten out of the house.
I need something not too ostentatious and not too spirited.
Not much of a rider, huh? The man's tone said. Must not be much of a man.
Confess your ineptitude and fall on his mercy, Kip.
What's your name, shit-shoveler?
He demanded instead.
Oops.
The groom blinked and stood up straight unconsciously.
Gallos.
Sir, he added uncertainly.
I don't ride these stinking meat barrels much, but I need one that's reliable, that can handle my fat ass, and that won't panic when I use magic. You understand? And I don't have time for your superciliosity.
Was that even a word? Kip bawled forward. The groom probably didn't know either.
There's a war on. Get me my damned horse and save the shit packing for your stable boys.
The groom moved with alacrity, saddling an old draft horse.
Best I've got for what you've asked, sir, the man said.
A draft horse? I'm not that fat.
Sorry, sir, only one I got.
It'll do, Kip said. Thank you. No need to press his luck. The stirrup did look impossibly high, however. Instead of humiliating himself by trying to mount and most likely failing, he took the reins and led the beast out into the city, taking care to tip the groom.
Rolum, I really was an asshole.
Kip didn't know what made it more disconcerting, that being an asshole had promptly gotten him his way, or that he had enjoyed exerting mastery over another man. Back home, he would have been whipped, and he would have deserved it. In the streets, he kept his eyes peeled until he found a man roughly his own size, wearing a coat despite the heat. It looked old, worn, and cost maybe as much as one of Kip's coat's pockets. Kip traded with the man. Then he bought wine and water in one of the streets leading to the water market, and was convincing a shopkeeper that he really did want to trade his fine cloak for a plain woolen one, when he heard loud voices. He turned. Some old man was standing in the back of a wagon, exhorting the crowd heading into the water market, most of whom were ignoring him.
"To have our own nation again, with our own king! You all want to ride under the boot-heel of the Parians again? Do you remember what they did last time? Have you no memory?"
"They killed hundreds for listening to nonsense like yours," someone shouted.
"And I say we don't have to let them ever do it again,"
the old man snapped back. That got some murmurs of agreement.
"Everyone who wanted to listen to your shilling for King Haradul has already left," a shopkeeper yelled.
"The king isn't willing that any should perish. Come, join him and fight."
"We don't want to fight. We don't want to kill. We don't want to be killed. We want to live."
"Cowards,"
the old man said. Then he shuffled off to look for a more sympathetic audience. Kit was about to head out of town when something caught his eye. There was a new ship in the bay, a galleon flying a white flag with seven towers, the Chromeria's flag. Almost at the moment that he identified the flag, he saw a line of men and women walking through the streets led by at least a dozen blackguards. He froze. Guilty conscience. They didn't know him, and he didn't see the only two blackguards he'd seen before, Stump and whatever the other one's name had been. And the people behind the blackguards were perhaps more interesting, though, and Kip studied them as they passed half a block away and turned down a street to head toward the Travertine Palace. There were perhaps 200 of them, and Kip was sure that every last one was a drafter. A few had eyes light enough that he could see their irises were solid blue or green or red, but some of the lighter-skinned among them actually had a visible tint to their skin. Some concealed that with long sleeves. Others didn't seem to care.
"Be true, but it looks better than the last time we were here, Sir Miller," a blue-tinged man said.
Despite his light-enough-to-show-colour skin, the man had his hair in dreadlocks almost to his waist. The woman was stunning, perhaps 40 years old, with solid blue irises, high cheekbones, and the olive skin of the Western Atashian upper classes. Both wore rich clothing.
"Sir Miller Sayer and Isom Blue?
No, surely not. Those names were just from stories. Surely there were plenty of drafters their age who happened to be blues and reds, who had special relationships with each other. Next came more blackguards, helping infirm drafters or wheeling them in chairs. Kip decided not to wait to see if Stump were with them. He turned to slip through the crowd and found himself face to face with Liv. She stood with her hands on her hips, her jaw tight. She flicked her eyes to the horse and back to Kip. Gulp.
"I can explain," Kip said. "You already did. Twice."
There was no amusement in her tone. She'd found both notes. Oh, hell.
"Don't stop me, Liv, please.
What do you think you're doing?"
She lowered her voice.
"You think you're going to spy? You're going to find Karis? And do what?"
His jaw set.
"I'm going to save her."
She made no effort to hide her incredulity.
"That is one of the more ridiculous things I've heard in my life, Kip. If you want to run away because it's too dangerous here, you don't need to pretend."
"Go to hell,"
he said, stunning even himself. Her eyes shot wide. He couldn't believe he'd said that to Liv.
"Liv, for Rohorim's sake."
"I'm sorry."
He said it too loud, and some people around them looked at him. He lowered his voice sheepishly.
"I'm really sorry. That was stupid to say, and mean. I didn't mean it. I... Liv..."
He paused, then bowled ahead.
"I'm nothing. I've been a nothing for my whole life. And I'm being catapulted into having people treat me different because of something I had no control over, because of my father."
He could see on her face that she understood. She knew exactly what he meant.
"Liv, I owe Gavin everything, but he hasn't asked anything of me."
"He will,"
Liv said darkly.
"Has he ever asked you to do anything wrong, Liv?"
"Not yet," she admitted. "I'm just saying that you have to look out for yourself when it comes to people from the Chromaria."
"And what? You're not one of them? If you make me go back, you'll be making me break my word."
"What?"
Liv looked like he'd just slapped her face.
"I swore that I was going to save Karis. Don't you see, Liv? I'm perfect, precisely because I'm a nothing. Look at my eyes."
Still confused, she looked at his eyes.
"No colour, no halo," Kip said. "But I can draft. Liv, for the first time in my life, I know exactly what I have to do. No one is making me do this. I'm doing it because it's right. There's something tremendously..."
He clenched his hands, trying to pull in the words.
"Freeing, powerful. I don't know what, but I know it feels good."
"Even if you go to your death?"
Liv asked. He chuckled joylessly.
"I'm not being a hero, Liv. I just don't like myself that much. So what if I die?"
"That's the most awful thing I've ever heard," Liv said.
"I'm sorry," Kip said. "I'm not trying to be pitiful. I'm just saying. I've got nothing. I'm an orphan, at best a bastard. A shame. I just don't have that much to lose. If I can do something good with my life, or even with my death, then how could I not try?"
He could see her wavering. For the first time, he had hope that he could actually get away with this.
"Please, Liv. If I fail in this, if I can't even get out of the city, I really am a nothing. Please, don't make me fail in the most important thing I've ever tried to do."
She blinked, then grinned.
"I never thought what might happen if you turned that wily tongue against me. You ought to be an orange."
"I do resemble one in general shape, but I'm not sure—"
"A drafter, not a fruit,"
she said, laughing.
Oh, he was like a slippery drafter. "Does this mean you're not going to stop me?"
Kip said.
"Worse," she said.
"Huh? You have to do what's right."
"I have to do what's right. You're my responsibility, Kip."
"Oh, no, you don't."
"Yes, I'm going with you, or you're not going."
"Liv, you don't understand."
She doesn't understand what?
"That you're totally smitten with her? That she's beautiful and smart and wonderful and amazing and your whole soul longs just to be with her, but you can't imagine putting her in danger?"
"I don't understand what?"
she asked.
"Damn it. You're light to me."
It slipped out. He couldn't believe he'd said it out loud. His eyes went wide even before hers did. He'd been nearly physically naked before her when that assassin had tried to kill him. This was worse. He was paralyzed. His lips failed him.
"Very funny, Kip, but you're not going to fool me and slip away when I'm not looking or something. You might be wily, but I wasn't born yesterday."
Oh, thank God, Horlam. She thought he was joking. A wave of relief passed over him, leaving his knees weak.
"I'm going with you," Liv said, "and that's final. You're right. What you're trying is a good thing. I know Caris is worth saving, and what she's learned could change the whole war. And if you want to succeed, you're going to need my help, and you'd be making me break my oath to look after you if you don't let me come."
He had used that "don't make me break my oath" thing as the whole linchpin of his argument. He didn't particularly like having it turned against him, but with his whole brain in a fog, his heart was still pounding hard, he couldn't exactly counter it.
"Besides," Liv said more quietly, "even if you're not running away from anything, maybe one of us is."
"Huh?" Kip said.
"Huh is the best I can manage?"
"Great."
"I'm coming. Let's go," Liv said.
Together they found the old man who'd been shouting at the crowd earlier and got directions to King Haradul's army.
"Head south and follow the tracks. Thousands have gone already. If you want to join the army rather than be useless like the rest of the camp followers, tell the recruiting sergeant that Harain sent you."
The guards at the Hag's Gate didn't even look at them twice. Outside the city, Kip found a rock, stood on it, and wiggled his way into the saddle. Liv took his hand and climbed up behind him. The huge draft horse seemed to have no trouble with the weight. Kip willed himself to relax as Liv put her arms around his waist to hold on. Still, Kip hesitated, looking north, looking back at Garriston.
"Come on, Kip. You've done dumber things and lived to tell the tale."
Not so sure about that. Still, Kip prodded the big horse, and they began the long trip. Chapter 67. It started as a dull throb. It always did. For a while, Caris hoped her stomach was reacting to the food King Haradul was practically forcing down her gullet. Caris hadn't had her moon blood in 6 months. Like most of the women of the Black Guard, her flow was irregular at best. Their level of training simply precluded it. But when Caris had hers, it was like her body was making up for lost pain. Damn King Haradul. This was his fault. The enforced boredom was driving Caris mad, sitting in the wagon, unable to do much and constantly checked on. When they'd found her doing strength exercises, they'd sent in 3 drafters and 2 mirrormen. The 6 barely all fit in the little wagon. Caris had been seized by the mirrormen and laid over the knee of one of the drafters, literally laid over her knee. The woman had produced a man's leather belt and beat Caris's bottom raw, like she was a recalcitrant child. She'd been caught 3 times, and the punishment never changed. But gradually her will to resist did. It had seemed like too small and inconsequential a rebellion to keep up. Now she wished she had. The throbbing was already spreading to her back. Not long now for the diarrhea to start. Love being a woman. The other women of the Black Guard took advantage of their relative freedom from moon blood as also granting relative freedom from worrying about pregnancy. Caris just enjoyed her relative freedom from pain. It had been years since she'd had sex with anything more than her pillow. Not that she wanted to think about that right now. In fact, she thought if she even saw a man, she'd tear his eyes out. It was for men that women suffered this. As the old saw said, a woman has to bleed to fertilize man's seed. Chronologically confused, but true enough. They brought her the dress in the morning. It wasn't the kind of clothing one would expect to be asked to wear for one's execution. It wasn't an exact copy of the dress she'd worn when she'd finally given in to her father's demands and joined Gavin at the head of his armies when they'd reclaimed Rue, but it was close. For one thing, it was black silk rather than green. King Haradul's tailor had obviously been working either from memory or a painting of the day, or they had simply decided to alter the dress for the changes of 16 years of fashion. The fit would be perfect, of course. Caris stared at the dress with loathing all day, as cramps racked her guts, as the inevitable diarrhea came, as she nearly passed out a couple of times. That dress symbolized more than giving in to Rask Haradul's childish fantasy. That dress was Caris's youth. It was the girl she'd been. It was femininity, softness, yielding, the desperate grubbing for people's eyes, for the jealousy of the other girls, for the envy of older women, for the attention of men. Caris had been weak and petty and stupid, hopelessly dependent. They would force her to wear the dress, of course. She could wear it now or be beaten until she gave in and wore it. Of course, she could tear it to shreds. While satisfying, that would only delay the inevitable. Besides, they weren't going to let her out of here without the dress. She was certain of that much. What she didn't know was if they would let her out even with the dress. Still, it was a better chance than nothing. And how was she going to kill Ras Caradul from in here? She put on the dress. She wanted to hate it. She wanted to hate it with a passion. But she hadn't worn anything that fit her so well in years. Her blackguard garb, of course, fit like a glove, but those were work clothes. This, the whisper of fine silk on skin, was altogether different. It fit like a sheath. If it hadn't been so perfectly tailored, she wouldn't have been able to breathe, much less move. The dress was curve-hugging around her hips and stomach, and the more generous scalloped neckline drew attention to both the liquid dazzle of folds of fine silk and to her cleavage. Surely her old dress hadn't been so low-cut in the back, the few thin interlaced ties only emphasizing her back's essential nakedness. Looking down at her chest, there was no mirror in the room, she hoped she didn't get cold. If she did, everyone was going to know it. Had her dress been unlined when she was that stupid 16-year-old? Had she even noticed? She honestly couldn't remember. All she could remember was loving that dress. She'd felt like the goddess Atarat, standing next to Gavin in it, long hair caught up in a diamond and emerald-encrusted tiara, people practically worshipping them. She'd convinced herself that she could love Gavin. At first, before the Lux Lord's ball, she'd felt more attraction toward him than toward Dazen. Surely she could blow that coal back to flame. Dazen had been perpetually in his elder brother's shadow, and he seemed content with it. Gavin had been so confident, so masterful. She'd been drawn to him irresistibly, as everyone had. But after that night at the Lux Lord's ball, everything had changed. After she got to know Dazen, suddenly there hadn't seemed to be much depth to Gavin. Dazen had never understood his own strength. He had worshipped Gavin, projected all his own virtues onto his older brother, been blind to his faults and exaggerated his qualities. Gavin had fed on all the adoration and grown fat on it. But Gavin was still gorgeous, stylish, commanding, and admired. To the 16-year-old Caris, other people's regard had been very important. She'd always wanted to please her father, her mother, Koyos, and her other brothers, her magisters, everyone. Gavin was everything good. He was the prism, his brother by that point a disgraced runaway and a murderer. Caris remembered convincing herself she could be content with the prism. Content. With the most admired, feared, desired man in the Seven Satrapies. Besides, after what Dazen had done, she had to marry Gavin, or what was left of her family would be ruined. On the platform announcing their betrothal, Caris had thought she really was going to be happy. She had admired her fiancé. Gavin always cut a fine figure. She had enjoyed every minute of the attention. At dinner that night, Gavin had made a jest to her father about taking Caris back to his rooms and not sleeping a wink. Caris's father, ordinarily so traditional, the man who'd always sworn his daughter wouldn't give milk until some young satrap bought the whole cow, the man who had beaten Caris for giving her virginity to Dazen, that man, that hypocrite, that coward, had chuckled nervously. Until that moment, Caris had been able to stave off her rising panic. "At least I won't have to sleep with him until we're married," she'd thought. "I'll be able to fall in love with him in the coming months. I'll forget Dazen. I'll forget my shivers when he kissed the back of my neck. I'll forget that swelling in my chest I felt every time he gave that reckless grin. Everyone else is right. Dazen isn't half the man Gavin is. I can't love Dazen after what he did." But there had been no escape. Caris had chosen her own kind of cowardice and gotten roaring drunk. Her father had noticed too late, or just in time, depending on how you looked at it, and forbade the servants from giving her more wine before she could pass out at the table. She couldn't even remember what she'd said at the table, but she did remember Gavin half-carrying her back to his room. Her father had watched her go with empty eyes. He said nothing. She thought being drunk would help her be docile, quiet, malleable. It had worked, and she didn't know why she was so bitterly disappointed about that. When she'd turned her face away from his kisses, he'd mistaken it for shyness and kissed elsewhere. When he'd pulled off her slip and she'd covered herself with her hands, he'd mistaken it for modesty. Modest? When she'd been with Dazen, she'd gloried in his eyes on her. She'd been bold, shameless, she'd felt like a woman. Though now she knew she'd only been playing at being a woman in so many ways. With Dazen, she'd felt beautiful. With Gavin, she was filled with such unutterable despair it choked her cries in her own throat. She couldn't remember if she'd even protested, if she'd asked him to stop. She'd wanted to, but her memory was fogged. She didn't think she had. She'd kept thinking of her father, saying, "Our family needs this. Without this marriage, we're ruined." And she hadn't fought. She remembered crying, though, during. A gentleman would have stopped. But Gavin had been drunk and young and horny. There was no gentleness in him. When she wasn't ready, and he was hurting her, he'd ignored her protests and thrust with a young man's need. Far from keeping her awake all night, as he'd bragged, he'd soon finished. Then he'd told her to leave. The casual cruelty of it had taken her breath away, and she'd taken it. She should have clawed his eyes out. He hadn't wanted Caris. He'd wanted to show that Dazen couldn't have what rightfully belonged to him. Caris might as well have been a tree for him to piss on after the last dog, reclaiming his territory. She'd stumbled through the halls in that beautiful dress with half its buttons undone. The damn thing required the help of servants to button. She'd been seen, of course. Somehow she got home. Not their home on Big Jasper that had burned to the ground, but to their apartments nearby. Her father had been waiting up, but he didn't say a word. Just stared at her. Her room slave had undressed her with trembling fingers, and when Caris had finally fallen in bed, the doorway of her room was darkened with her father's silhouette. He wobbled, leaned against the doorframe.
"I could challenge him to a duel," he said. "But he'd kill me, Caris, and then you'd be ruined, hopeless. We'd lose everything our fathers had fought for 50 generations. Maybe tomorrow we'll look better."
She'd been winesick for 2 days, and when she'd emerged, Gavin had kissed her in public, seated her at his right hand, and treated her like a queen. It was like the night had never happened, or like it had been beautiful. Later she decided it was because everyone had been talking about the two of them as such a perfect couple, of how beautiful she was, and Gavin had decided she suited his image, so instead of casting her aside, he'd decided to go through with a marriage. But then he'd left, and soon after fought the final battle at Sundered Rock. When he came back, he seemed like a different man. He treated her with a genuine warmth, respect. So unlike the man who'd banished her from his bedchamber after he took his pleasure of her. It made Caris doubt that the night had happened at all. She could have convinced herself that it had all been a nightmare, until she found out she was pregnant. The very day she'd become aware of it, before she could tell him, Gavin had broken their betrothal. She'd been 16, pregnant, and without any prospect of marriage. In other words, her father's perfect nightmare. As soon as she was certain she wasn't going to miscarry, she'd told her father. He demanded she see the chirurgeons and get it taken care of. For the first time in her life, she'd refused her father. To hell with him. He moved to strike her. She pulled out a pistol. She told him she'd hollow out his skull if he dared to strike her. She told him he was a coward. She was going to bear Gavin's bastard and let the world know it was his. To hell with him, and to hell with her father, and to hell with everyone. Bearing that child would be her first free act, and her revenge. Her father had gotten down on his knees and begged. Literally begged. "Please save our family. We can't be the ones who let down all the generations of White Oaks who sacrificed everything to get us here. We and us," he said. He meant I and me. He was the one who had destroyed the family, and he knew it. He looked so small and weak, cold sweat gleaming off his balding head. Abruptly, she despised him. He'd been the absolute lord over her, and he was disgusting. She refused his pleas, and she felt pleasure at the sick, slack despair in his eyes. 2 days later, her father kissed the double barrels of a pistol and blew out his own brains. His ledger books were all in order. That was how he'd spent those 2 days. All the family properties had been sold to pay off their debts, leaving Caddis enough to live on quietly for the rest of her life, enough to support her illegitimate child. Her father had taken care of everything. His suicide note had simply explained where the remaining monies were, and told Caddis where to go if she wanted to bear her child in secret. It didn't beg her to do so. Indeed, there was no emotion in the note whatsoever. No curses, no forgiveness, no regrets. It was as empty as his skull after the musket balls passed through them, just gore and black powder residue. Ordure and death. Hollow. Messy. She couldn't stand to stay on the Jaspers. Couldn't endure the pity and the awkward glances, so she'd left, going to a distant cousin's house deep in the Blood Forest. She'd borne the child and given it up immediately, not even hugging it, asking not even to know its gender, and learning only through her host's indiscretion that it was a boy. The family, adopting Gavin's get, lived nearby, and Caddis couldn't bear to stay, so she'd gone back to the Cromeria. She'd lost the baby weight in short order, and her young skin barely even showed any stretch marks. It was like nothing had happened, except for the memories clinging to her like hellstone eating her soul. Fitting that my new dress is black, then, huh? A little piece of midnight, like what's inside me. Thought you left the melodrama behind, Caris. Go bend over a fence. I think that's what the king is hoping for. That'll be a treat for both of us. Hope he enjoys blood. So, what? I'm supposed to be thankful that I'm flowing now? Not much chance. A cramp racked her in mid-thought. Caris hunched. Not much thankfulness here. While she was hunched over, a slip of paper was pushed under the door. Caris picked it up. It was no bigger than her finger. Orders, Assass, KG, Dark, can't help. There was an old Daeric rune at the bottom. It was the agreed symbol to show it was from the agent Caris had been sent to meet, not well drawn, but correct. It wasn't much of a code, but they'd never figured Caris would need a code. She was supposed to have met the agent in person. He was to identify himself by idly tracing part of the rune on any surface, a table, dirt, whatever. Caris's orders were to assassinate King Haradul, secretly, and her contact wouldn't be able to help her. Perfect. Caris couldn't even burn the note, and though small, it was grimy. She popped it into her mouth with a grimace and swallowed. Her contact wouldn't be able to help her. Damn it, Caris, you've been thinking so much about the past, you haven't thought about the present. In one moment, Corvin had understood that someone must want Caris dead. Of all the White's agents, Caris had to be the worst person to send here. Either the White wanted Caris dead, or... there was no other possibility. Or she hoped I'd be kidnapped and maybe raped? Ludicrous. She knew she frustrated the White at times, but she'd thought the stubborn old woman liked her. Then again, the White always played a deep game. Maybe she thought she could use Caris's death to accomplish something else. Caris felt sick to her stomach. It was possible. She wouldn't have thought it before, but she'd sworn to give her life for the White if necessary. Maybe the White had decided it was necessary. There was a knock at her door. It was the same routine as before, lots of drafters, lots of guards. This time, however, several women bearing tins of powders and glosses came in. With the efficiency of professionals, they made up Caris, fixed her hair, and applied perfume, but they didn't apply any powder to her eyes or lashes. And soon enough, Caris found out why, as one of the slaves took out violet eye caps. Blind them! They'd thought of everything. "If you tear these off, you'll certainly rip your skin," one of the slave women said, "and possibly tear off your entire eyelid. If you leave them alone, the king may give you greater freedom, and it won't hurt your eyes. In a few days they will loosen and come off by themselves."
At which point you'll re-glue them, Karis said. Yes. But if I get something in my eye, it will be impossible to get it out. Try not to.
They tried the fit over her eye sockets. The caps weren't a perfect fit. The slave woman, Eastern Atashian, from her features, scowled.
To make the caps fit, we're going to have to use extra glue. Extra glue means if you blink, your eyelashes will get stuck. King Haradul wants you for your beauty, so I don't want to cut off your eyelashes if I can help it. But once we set the caps on your face, they'll be there for days. You really don't want your eyelashes globbed with glue, or stuck in it. So, do you want to be blind, irritated, or lashless?
Lashless. And to hell with Rask, Caris said. The slave pursed her lips.
You're right, the king might be annoyed. We'll have to take our chances. Blink right now as much as you can, because you're going to have to not blink for as long as possible.
With great care and globs of glue, they put the eye caps on. The glue globs took care of the gaps left in the fit. Caris barely dared breathe, holding as still as possible, forcing herself not to blink. When she finally broke down and had to blink, her lashes caught for a moment in the drying glue, but pulled free.
"Oh, and try not to cry," the slave said, "or you'll be up to your eyeballs in tears." Literally.